We're going to turn in the Word of God to Esther chapter 2. I'm going to read from verse 16 through to verse 5 of chapter 3. Esther is taken into King Ahasuerus after that prolonged year-long beautification process. And in Esther 2, verse 16, we read, "So Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. The king loved Esther more than all the other women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king made a great feast, the feast of Esther, for all his officials and servants, and he proclaimed a holiday in the provinces and gave gifts according to the generosity of a king. When virgins were gathered together a second time, Mordecai sat within the king's gate. Now Esther had not revealed her family and her people, just as Mordecai had charged her, for Esther obeyed the command of Mordecai as when she was brought up by him. In those days, when Mordecai sat within the king's gate, two of the king's eunuchs, Bigthan and Teresh, doorkeepers, became furious and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. So the matter became known to Mordecai, who told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. And when an inquiry was made into the matter, it was confirmed, and both were hanged on a gallows, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes who were with him. And all the king's servants who were within the king's gate bowed and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai would not bow or pay homage. Then the king's servants who were with the king, within the king's gate, said to Mordecai, 'Why do you transgress the king's command?' Now it happened when they spoke to him daily, and he would not listen to them, that they told it to Haman to see whether Mordecai's words would stand, for Mordecai had told them that he was a Jew. When Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow or pay him homage, Haman was filled with wrath." We'll end our reading there at verse 5, chapter 3. Friends, Esther, as you know, as I said last week, is one of two books in the Bible that doesn't contain the name of God. But it's impossible to read Esther without recognizing the hand of God in the unfolding events. I said last week, this is just an overview of the book. We started it last week. We'll finish it next week. But it just, I thought it would be useful in the wake of recent terrorist attacks in the general election that was looming last week, to look at this book, because we live in a society when even terrorist attacks happen, and even when, you know, political parties publish their manifesto, God doesn't feature. And we live in a book, we live in a time which is not like the book of Esther. You know, God doesn't feature on the pages of Esther, but he's certainly there. And God doesn't feature in the vocabulary of many within our society. They don't take him or his laws into account. But it doesn't mean that God isn't there. God is still working. Now, last week we got as far as that portion of that part in chapter 2, where Esther is introduced to Xerxes, his Greek rendering of his name, or Ahasuerus. But we found all the women brought before the king. The king loved Esther, we are told, more than all the other women. Now, friends, when you read the book, it's like a Cinderella story. Esther stole the king's heart. Esther became his queen. Here is this obscure Jewish orphan, a child of exiled people, a conquered people. She's exalted to the highest position that any woman could have in the entire world at that particular time. Now, that is no coincidence. You see, friends, although God's name is not mentioned, we recognize that there's a power working here greater than Ahasuerus. There's a power at work providentially. And that power, that sovereign hand, is orchestrating his own purposes through the actions of this pagan emperor. Now, significantly through the entire process, Esther keeps her Jewishness a secret. Mordecai told her to do that because there was much anti-Semitism in the Persian Empire. And you can see that in chapter 4. Esther in chapter 4 is going to reveal that she was Jewish, but only at the very most important and necessary time. My friends, not long after Esther is crowned, and this is where the story gets really interesting, her cousin Mordecai is sitting at the entrance of the palace, and he's hanging around the palace. And you know, you think, well, why is he doing that? Well, remember, who raised Esther? It was Mordecai. And Mordecai is concerned about her. And so he hangs around the palace to get whatever word he can from her and also word about her. And while he's hanging around the palace, we're told at the end of chapter 2 and verse 21 that two of the king's eunuchs, Bigthan and Teresh, these two doorkeepers, became furious with Ahasuerus and sought to lay hands on him and kill him. Now, Mordecai, and again, it's not coincidence, Mordecai providentially overhears that plot to kill the king, to assassinate the king. These were royal officials who guarded the king's private chambers. They had access to him and could quite easily assassinate him. And we're told they were angry, they were furious. Maybe they were angry because of that failed Greek military adventure which we mentioned last week. You know, it was a bit of a disaster. And perhaps they're thinking, well, this guy isn't the god that he thinks he is. And so he's made a complete mess of this. And what we'll do is we'll kill him and bring about a coup d'etat or something like that. Maybe that's what we're thinking. But whatever it is that infuriated them, they were plotting to take the king's life. And Mordecai just happened to overhear this. Now, when he learned about the plot against the king, he reported it immediately. And when an inquiry was made into the matter, it was indeed confirmed. And both of the culprits were hanged on the gallows. And listen to what it says at the end of chapter 2. And it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. You know, the Persians kept records, meticulous records of absolutely everything. That's why we know so much about, you know, the Persians. That's why we know so much about their history. So the king's chroniclers recorded what had happened. They record that the plot, that it had been overheard by Esther, or overheard by Mordecai, who had reported it to Esther, and Esther had informed the king. And the king's life had been spared. The two conspirators meet their end. Mordecai's actions were written down in the royal record. Why did they do that? Because those kind of things needed to be rewarded, and kings knew that. Loyalty needed to be rewarded as much as disloyalty needed to be punished. And at a future day, there would come a time when this man would be rewarded for saving the life of the king. Like all the ancient monarchs, Ahasuerus was careful to honor and reward those who demonstrated loyalty to him. Now, all of that brings us to the end of chapter 2. And then you come into chapter 3. And you're introduced to this next main character. Actually, the fill-in of the book, a man named Haman. This is a man who had been exalted to a position of power and authority within the empire. He's a capable man, a man who had been lifted above the princes, other princes and royal officials. But there's something very interesting about this man, and this is the key to the whole story. He was an Agagite, and that's what it says in chapter 3, verses 1 through to 10. It says it again in chapter 8, and we are informed of it again in chapter 9. He is Haman the Agagite. It keeps repeating that. My friends, that's not a small detail. It's the origin of Haman's hatred for Mordecai and his hatred for the Jews. Now, to understand that, it's important to know that he was an Agagite. And to trace that, you can trace it in the Bible, you need to go back 1,000 years, or almost 1,000 years in the past. Go back to those years when Israel, the people of Israel, the children of God, were coming out of Egypt during the Exodus. And the Israelites come out of Egypt and they're attacked. And they're attacked by a group of people called the Amalekites. The Amalekites are the descendants of Esau, the one who sold his birthright. Now, because the Amalekites attacked the Jews, God cursed the Amalekites. And God's curse is in Deuteronomy chapter 25. And it basically says, one day, the Lord is going to execute judgment, and the Amalekites, you Amalekites, you're going to be extinct. 4 centuries later, King Saul conquers the Amalekites. And he captures their king, and his name is Agag. Saul was supposed to kill him, and Saul didn't, Saul let him live. And Saul incurred the Lord's displeasure, and for that, and for some other things that he did that displeased the Lord, the throne was removed from the family of Saul. And the prophet Samuel steps in. And we know what the prophet Samuel did to Agag. Cut him up in little pieces. It was a very bloody end to this Amalekite king. Now Haman, here we are, almost 1,000 years later. And about 1,500 years later, Haman was an Agagite. And though, as I say, it's almost, a millennium and a half, since, Saul's encounter, and 400 years before that, when they came out of Egypt, and God says this race is going to be extinct, hundreds of years have passed since the hacking and the death of this man's ancestor. Haman knew his family history, and he knew that it was a Jewish man that had hacked his ancestor to death, and he knew that that Jewish man was a prophet by the name of Samuel. And to make it worse, Mordecai is descendant from Kish. We're told that in chapter 2, verse 5. And Kish is from the tribe of Benjamin. And Benjamin is the line of Saul. See, friends, these people knew their history. There was deep-seated animosity between the descendants of Saul and the descendants of Agag for obvious reasons. And the hostility erupts in chapter 3, verse 2. We'll read from verse 2 and then down to verse 5 and 6. So chapter 3, verse 2. All the king's servants who were within the king's gate bowed and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai would not bow or pay homage. Now down to verse 4. Now it happened when they spoke to him daily, and he would not listen to them, that they told it to Haman to see whether Mordecai's words would stand. For Mordecai had told them that he was a Jew. When Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow or pay homage to him, Haman was filled with wrath. And what does Haman do? Well, he goes to the magicians and he goes to the astrologers and he says to them, I want you to determine the optimum day by looking into all your mystical, you know, sources. I want you to find the optimum day for annihilating the Jewish people. We'll have genocide all over the empire on that one day that's written in the stars. And then he goes to the king and he says to the king, this nation, this Persian empire is full of Jews and they are a threat to the emperor. They're a threat to your throne. They're a threat to your empire. And because of that, they ought to be eliminated. And he says they ought to be killed not only here in the capital, but all the way back to Israel. We need to get them wherever they are in the empire. We need to kill them. We need to eradicate them, even those who have returned. And friends, you know, the Hamans of this world are still around today. Those who are still trying to silence the people of God, trying to eliminate the people of God, trying to annihilate the people of God. And furthermore, Haman suggests, you know, if we kill all these Jews, we will be able to confiscate all of their property and all their spoils and everything they own. And a vast sum of money will come into the coffers of the royal treasury. Now, after a disastrous campaign in Greece, that must have been music to Ahasuerus' ears. And Ahasuerus says, great idea. So he hands his signet ring over to Haman so that Haman can stamp, you know, the documents with the king's ring and authorize the genocide of the Jews. Now, Haman hits the ground running. He dispatches a royal decree, sends it all through the empire, and they did it much like the old Pony Express in the Wild West. You know, a horse with a rider, you know, would ride post haste with the message, get as far as that horse could, you know, go, and then another horse, another rider would take over from there. It would spread very rapidly around the empire. And the date is established for the execution, the elimination of the Jews. Look at verse 13 in chapter 3. The letters were sent by couriers into all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, in the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their possessions. And if you look into chapter 4, verse 3, it says, in every province where the king's command and decree arrived, there was great mourning among the Jews, and fasting, weeping, wailing, and many lay in sackcloth and ashes. This message is stretched right across the massive Persian Empire very rapidly. A date set for the execution of the people of the Jewish race The time of the slaughter has been set. And when Mordecai, as you know, hears about this genocide, he also tore his clothes. He dressed in rags. He put ashes on his head. He mourns openly. He mourned publicly at this horrendous decree, the mass murder, the genocide of an entire race. This wasn't just simply, you know, payback by Haman. You know, it's much, much bigger than that. Satan is involved in this. Satan is involved in the efforts to obliterate the Jewish people and thus bring to a halt God's purpose of redemption on their behalf. Satan didn't want the Messiah coming. Satan didn't want the singing, you know, let earth and heaven combine, angels and men agree. He wanted to thwart that. Satan wanted to bring a halt to God's purpose of redemption on their behalf and our behalf. And friends, it didn't take long for news to reach Esther. Esther gets the message. Mordecai informs Esther of what Haman had succeeded in accomplishing, and even gives her a copy of the royal decree. And he says to her, Esther, you have to go to the king. And you have to plead for the lives of your people. Now, we know that that wasn't such a simple task. And we saw last week, you know, what a tyrant this man was. You know, in Persia, no one, including the queen, went before the king without a personal invitation. And anybody who ventured into the king's presence without being invited by the king could be killed on the spot. So Esther not only knew that she would be breaking royal protocol, but she would be risking her life. What it says in verse 11 of chapter 4, all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that any man or woman who goes into the inner court of the king who has not been called, he has but one law, put all to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter that he may live. Yet I myself have not been called to go into the king these 30 days. It's a month since the king called me into his presence. And she is understandably afraid. Afraid of potentially violating her irrational husband who had demoted Vashti. Her irrational husband who demoted Vashti for one of her, you know, episodes of non-compliance. And Mordecai was putting Esther in a position where she could lose her life. Well, Mordecai, as we know, comes back and he calls for courage. Calls for this young woman to have courage. Look what he says at verse 13 and 14, again of chapter 4, Mordecai told him to answer Esther. Do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. That famous verse. You know, don't think you're going to escape, Esther. You know, Mordecai is warning his young cousin. Look, you're dead if you do, and you're dead if you don't. You're in a catch-22 here, Esther. They're going to find out that you're Jewish and you're going to be dead if you don't do anything. Don't think just because you're in the royal palace that you are going to escape. And as he says in verse 14, for if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. Now, friends, that's wonderful confidence in the promises of God. And in these dark days in which we live, we need to have the same confidence in the promises of God, the covenant God of Israel. We need to have confidence in him and his promises to bless and sustain and preserve them as he did back then and us today. Mordecai says, look, God will deliver. He will deliver, but you won't survive. And then this famous line at the end of the verse, yet Esther, who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? And you see, friends, in this book that doesn't mention the name of God, he affirms divine sovereignty. He affirms his confidence in the revelation of God that God would preserve his people. But Mordecai also understands that Esther can perish, and that he also can perish, and many other Jews can perish if Esther doesn't act. Down in verse 16, Esther tells him to say to Mordecai, go, gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan, fast for me. Neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day, my maids and I will fast likewise. And so I will go to the king, which is against the law, and if I perish, I perish. You know, even if it costs me my life, I will do this. Now, Esther, in that verse, you notice she doesn't mention prayer, but she does mention fasting. And friends, there's no fast without prayer. So they're praying as well as fasting. For 3 days, they and the others in the capital are praying and fasting. And then she approaches the throne. You know, for ourselves who have, you know, as I said last week, we've gone through this book a couple of times several years ago. But we're familiar with this tremendous little story. And sometimes because we're familiar with it, you know, we'll lose that heart-stopping moment of suspense. You know, what's going to happen next? You know, we'll lose the tenseness of the moment. The seconds that she waited to see whether the king extends his scepter to welcome his queen into his presence. She comes in and he looks at her. What's he going to do? And he extends the scepter. Who's working in the king's heart? Who's overruling? God is. The God who's not mentioned in the book. But he's there. Very evidently there. And he extends the scepter and he asks the question in typical royal hyperbole. What do you wish, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given to you up to half of the kingdom. Well, she doesn't ask for half of the kingdom. She doesn't ask for the latest state-of-the-art chariot. She wants the lives of her people. But she doesn't disclose that yet. And Esther's reply to the king was oh so simple. She asked Ahasuerus to hold a banquet. Well, come have a banquet. And we'll invite Haman. Very simple, isn't it? And Ahasuerus is probably thinking she's doing the woman thing. But yet, the Lord's leading her. She is hatching a plan. And Haman comes later that day. What you want, Esther? You name it. Up to half of the kingdom, and it's yours. Let's have a banquet again tomorrow morning. And the plan is moving. She didn't ask for half the kingdom. She simply asked for banquet, the king, the queen, and Haman. And Haman, as we know, thinks he's landed. It's fascinating. And as I say, in this age in which we live, these days in which we live, when there is so much happening, and, you know, we said last week with the political parties, you know, not one mention of God or Christianity in their manifestos, those terrorist attacks, what was, you know, striking about it was nobody was sort of acknowledging God or thanking God. Notice today on the some of those interviewed who came out of that tower block, you know, they were talking about, you know, we made a reference, you know, to God, and you know, the reason I'm here is because only by the grace of God. They didn't use that term, but that's what they meant. But you see, friends, at times we can despair, living in, you know, this secular humanistic society that tries to write God out of the equation, and you never hear him mentioned. But a book like this reminds us that God is overruling, that God is working in the hearts and the minds, even of those who are the enemies of the people of God. And he's working in them in order to bring about what is good for the people of God, and what is good for the gospel, and what is good for the furtherance of the gospel within a given kingdom. So let's not despair. Let's not be downcast. And let's not have our heads drooping.